Everybody, it is 1 p.m. Eastern, so we are going to kick off today's training. I'd like to start with some housekeeping rules for today while in Zoom webinar. This training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Clueinn for those not able to join us live. The Clueinn training page offers the slides available for download under Download Training Materials. Please use the Q&A box to ask any questions, make comments, or report any technical problems that you encounter today. We will have two question and answer breaks, the first about halfway through the training, with the second at the end of the modules today. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form, which is also located on the Clueinn training page that brought you here today. Once you complete the form and click the box to certify that you participated, a certificate will be provided to you. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Clueinn. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, I'd like to welcome everybody to today's training, an introduction to PFAS, which is based upon the ITRC PFAS team online guidance resources. My name is Devin Sechkar, and I am going to be your moderator today. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from the state agencies, federal government, private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, we encourage you to visit our website where you can find more about the active teams that are up for registration and how to become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On slide number four, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers joining us today for the PFAS 101 training. All of our trainers have not only been team members and volunteered to help create the resources, but also have made this training possible. So I'd like to say a big thank you to our group of trainers today. And with that, I will be handing it off to Christy Herzer from the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation.
Thank you so much, Devin. All right, again, welcome. And whether it is morning, afternoon, or evening, welcome to the introduction to PFAS. And I am Christy Herzer with Vermont DEC. Just an overview of our training today. I will be introducing ITRC as well as the PFAS team, and then I will pass it on to Mitch, who will go over naming conventions and sources. Then you'll hear from Shalene about aqueous film-forming foams. Next, we'll learn from Sandra about fate and transport and site characterization. Then we'll have our first 10-minute question and answer break. After the break, I will talk to you about sampling and analysis for PFAS. And then I will pass it on to Andy, who will tell you about treatment technologies. And we will finish up the training with our last question and answer break. So again, the Interstate Technology Regulatory Council, or ITRC, is a 501c3 program of the Environmental Council of the States, or ECOS. We are comprised of over 1,000 members, including state, federal, stakeholder, tribal, academic, and industry members. We are a state-led coalition funded through federal grants as well as industry membership fees with the goal of advancing the use of environmental technologies and approaches. So we have a quick poll that's going to open on your screen, and we would love for you to fill it out. Which of the following best characterizes your experience with PFAS in environmental sites? The choices are none at all, less than a year, or just a couple of sites, 2 to 5 years, or a dozen or so sites, or 5 plus years, or 20 and more sites. So as folks fill out this poll, just as a reminder, this is a training intended for those who are relatively new to PFAS. However, be on the lookout for our Beyond the Basics PFAS training modules to be offered later this spring and summer for a deeper dive into topics. So we'll give it just another, oh, here are the answers. All right, so great. Looks like it is definitely skewing to folks who either don't have any experience with PFAS in environmental sites or just a few sites or less than a year. So excellent. So moving on to the PFAS team. We are comprised of just over 500 professionals across all sectors, and we come together to share our expertise and interests to develop readily accessible technical resources. Our team strives to provide a balanced overview of the current state of knowledge about PFAS in order to support decision-making associated with the management of PFAS contamination. The ITRC PFAS team is continuing our work in 2024 and 2025 to develop priority topics, keeping our external tables updated and generating training content. So, if you're interested in participating, head to the ITRC website to join the PFAS team. We encourage you to take a look at our consensus-driven free technical resources, which can all be found on our website. You can find our technical and regulatory guidance document, or TechReg for short, with the latest version from September of 2023. We also have 13 fact sheets, which were updated to remain current with the TechReg. We have video modules, and then we also have outreach, such as today's training. In addition, we have a number of external tables and information you can download and access quickly, such as the soil and regulatory guidance values table, which is updated approximately quarterly. I mentioned our 13 fact sheets, and here's the full list. All of our fact sheets go through the same rigorous review process as our TechReg and are updated to reflect the current information in the TechReg document. So, with that, I will pass the mic over to Mitch Olson.
Thank you, Christy. All right, stepping on board here. Well, we'll start things off here today with an overview of PFAS, including an introduction to some key terms and naming conventions, as well as an overview of PFAS, including history, uses, and some sources of PFAS into the environment. Now, there are several terms and acronyms we'll be referring to throughout the training today. So this first section of training will provide an overview to some of these terms. We will also talk briefly about PFAS chemistry. A lot of the unique features of PFAS chemistry are why PFAS have been so widely produced and used in society. The chemistry also contributes to the challenges of managing PFAS after they've been released into the environment. So I'll provide an overview of some of the key chemistry concepts of PFAS, as these will be referred to throughout the training today. So if you love chemistry and acronyms, like all of us in the ITRC PFAS team, then you're in for a treat. But welcome to the world of PFAS. During the training today, with each of these sections, we'll provide some reference information to the guidance document. There's a lot of great information that's available at the guidance document, and we'll be referring to that today. The information that I'll be referring to in this section today comes primarily from Chapter 2 of the guidance document. So, moving into this, PFAS is the acronym for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. This is a family of compounds that includes thousands of individual compounds. The family tree here is one way in which these thousands of compounds can be organized. At the highest level, PFAS can be divided into polymers and non-polymers. The polymers are primarily commercial and user products, consumer products that are made with PFAS. The polymer forms of PFAS are typically not as mobile in the environment as their non-polymer cousins. It's the non-polymers that we're primarily concerned about in the environment due to their mobility, as well as potential bioavailability. The non-polymers can be further divided into per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. I'll talk a little bit more about that on the next slide. And due to the wide variety of properties and chemical composition of different PFAS compounds, there's quite a number of groups and subgroups, hence the thousands of PFAS compounds that are part of the family. To highlight a few key features of what makes PFAS what they are, we have two example compounds shown here on the left-hand side. These are PFOA and PFOS. And as we'll discuss, these are only two of the thousands of PFAS compounds, but they're good representative compounds in terms of general features of PFAS. These are also the most well-studied and potentially notorious of the PFAS compounds. In terms of the PFAS family tree, these are non-polymers or perfluoroalkyl substances in the perfluoroalkyl acid or PFAA group on the upper left-hand side of the table, as we see here. And I'll talk a bit more about this particular group, the perfluoroalkyl acids, on the next slide as well. So most PFAS have a fluorinated tail and a non-fluorinated head. The tail consists of this carbon backbone bonded to fluorine. And is, in terms of properties, is both hydrophobic and oleophobic, repelling both oil and water. The head is non-fluoridated and may be polar or hydrophilic or attracting to water. I mean, for these compounds, not necessarily universally throughout the PFAS family. Both the head and the tail can take various shapes and forms in terms of the chemical structure, hence the need for multiple groups and subgroups within the PFAS family. The combined polar slash nonpolar molecule of PFAS is one of the unique features of the PFAS compounds. Another is the bond strength of the carbon fluorine bond, which makes PFAS very difficult to degrade, which we'll talk more about as we go through the training today. So once again, the PFAS are divided primarily into these perfluoroalkyl substances and polyfluoroalkyl substance categories. And looking closer at the difference between these two groups or subclasses in accordance with the family tree. In chemistry terms, per means saturated. So perfluorinated effectively means that the alkyl portion of the compound, that carbon backbone, is fully fluorinated, although bonded to a functional group at the end that cannot be further reduced. A primary group within the perfluoroalkyl substance subgroup is the perfluoroalkyl acids, or PFAAs. One thing I do want to call your attention to, this term PFAAs, perfluoroalkyl acids, in terms of the acronyms, just since there's some similar letters, there's potential room for some confusion here. That PFAS is the blanket term for PFA perfluoroalkyl substances. PFAAs is this family within the category. And we'll be referring to PFAAs regularly throughout the training today. So we do want to make sure we're clear on the difference between those two. The PFAAs can be further divided into perfluoroalkyl carboxylates or PFCAs and perfluoroalkyl sulfonates or PFSAs. The PFCAs include compounds such as PFOA, and as you'll see, the PFCAs, PFSAs look generally similar in terms of the chemical structure, but a different functional group. PFCAs have the carboxylate group. PFSAs have the sulfonate group. The PFSAs include PFOS as a representative compound within their category. Although a lot of modern PFAS production doesn't directly involve these PFAAs, historical formulations have, and the PFAAs are the group of compounds that are subject to most of the ongoing regulations. In contrast to the perfluoroalkyl substances, the polyfluoroalkyl substances, poly means multiple. So these are compounds that have multiple carbon fluorine bonds, but are not saturated. As shown by one example compound here, this 8,2-fluorotelomer alcohol has a similar carbon fluorine tail to the compound, but also includes some carbon in the head of the compound that's bonded to something besides fluorine that may be partially transformable or degradable. So I'll talk a little bit more about the perfluoroalkyl substances in a couple more slides, but for the next few slides, we'll focus on the PFAAs and some of the key features that make them of interest. Starting with naming conventions, there is a well-established naming convention for the PFAAs, which once you get familiar with it, it feels relatively simple. Starting with PF indicating that they're perfluoro compounds, and then a letter or a couple of letters that indicates the chain length, using standard organic chemistry type of nomenclature, where buta refers to 4, penta to 5, and so forth. And then the acronyms using a shorthand version of those naming. And then finally, some indicator of the functional group, which for the PFAAs is going to be either the sulfonate or the carboxylate, so either ending with S or A. And looking at this in tabular form, how this breaks apart, we can see the different chain lengths on the left-hand column, 4, 5, 6, moving on downwards. With each of these chain lengths, we have either a carboxylate or a sulfonate and an associated compound with the acronyms, associated acronyms noted on the third column. Looking closer at this, we'll pick apart a little bit further the number 8 on this column, which has the box drawn around it here. which O for octa, indicating the eight carbon chain. And this is where we find our friends PFOA and PFOS. One thing you may notice as we go through this table, looking at the right-hand three columns, is that there's the rows get further divided into these subcategories: perfluorooctanoate, perfluorooctanoic acid. I'll talk about that on the next slide, and that's really based on the acid-base chemistry of PFAS compounds. One final item I wanted to note on this slide, in terms of the carboxylates, so we're talking about PFOA and the related compounds of varying chain lengths. When we're counting the carbons for that chain length, it includes the carbon that's part of that carboxylate group. So there's one carbon that is in fact not fluorinated, but it's this N group that is not further reducible, and so therefore is included in the counting of the chain length. So wanted to include that as a mentioning, as that is a potential source of some confusion. Now, in terms of what PFAA we are talking about here, the conventional acid-base chemistry applies to the PFAAs. And this is another area that's a source of some confusion in terms of interpreting how results may be reported or explained. Effectively, one compound could be present in multiple forms, but effectively, it is still the same compound. This is based on acid-base chemistry, and it really can be thought of as similar to a hydrochloric acid or a table salt sodium chloride type chemistry, where sodium chloride, table salt, is present as a solid when it's in its salt form, sodium chloride. But then when dissolved in water, the sodium and the chloride separate, dissociate in the water. Similar applies to these PFAAs. They may be provided in solid form as a laboratory standard or something to that effect. Dissolved in water, they would then dissociate. And then similar with the acid chemistry. In the environment, all the PFAAs are almost entirely present in the anion form, that form in the left-hand side where the acid or the salt would be dissociated. Although we do see the acid form of the name often used interchangeably, as illustrated on the previous slide. Also worth noting here is that sometimes regulatory standards are presented for all three of these forms of the same compound. So you might end up seeing three entries on a regulatory value table, all effectively referring to the same compound. Another feature of the PFAAs that we'll refer to regularly going through this training today, so I wanted to call a little extra attention to, is the idea of the chain length. This table here, which is taken from the regulatory guidance table 2.3 from the guidance document, illustrates the short chain versus long chain version for both the PFCAs and the PFSAs. PFCA is shown on the upper part of the table, PFSAs on the lower part. Now, these are, if you recall that table from a couple slides ago, these are shown in order of increasing chain length. PFBA, PFBS are four carbon chain compounds. You see PFOA, PFOS, the eight carbon chain compounds in the middle, and then increasing onward. For a little extra fun and confusion in the PFAS world, the division between short chain and long chain is not the same for the PFCAs and PFSAs. Anything six carbon or longer for the PFSAs is considered long chain, eight chain or longer for the PFCAs, which is related partially to the fact that the carbon that's not fluorinated is counted as part of the CFAs, PFCAs. But also, and more importantly, it's related to the behavior of the different compounds. It's eight chain or longer PFCAs that behave like long chain PFAS, or six chain longer for the PFSAs that behave more like long chains. And we'll refer to this more as we go through the training today. Okay, the other major class of PFAS we need to be concerned about in the environment is the polyfluoroalkyl substances. I've mentioned this earlier, that poly means multiple carbon-fluorine bonds, but they're not saturated. A feature of these polyfluoroalkyl substances is that there is carbon present on these compounds that is bonded to something other than fluorine. And as I mentioned, it may be partially degradable, although not considered to be completely degradable. The part of the compound where we see the carbon-fluorine bonds is not likely to be degraded or transformed, except for under some fairly extreme conditions. So the key item to note for polyfluoroalkyl substances is a non-fluorine carbon, a non-fluorinated carbon attached. These may be susceptible to biological or abiotic processes that can lead to transformation. And this transformation can then ultimately lead to formation of PFAAs as end products. Sometimes we refer to the PFAAs as terminal PFAAs, as they're the end products of degradation and will not degrade further. Conversely, we often refer to polyfluoroalkyl substances as precursors or PFAA precursors because they can partially transform into those PFAAs. There's one example of a polyfluoral substance shown here, 8,2-fluorotelomer alcohol. And we can see the carbon fluorine chain on the left-hand side. The right-hand side, those carbons may be susceptible to some degradation. These fluorotelomers are named using an NX convention, referring to the length of the chain of both sides of this particular compound. And to further elaborate on this concept of precursors, most of what we refer to as precursors are polyfluoroalkyl substances, but there are some that are considered as perfluoroalkyl substances, but are precursors because they can partially degrade, even though it's not a carbon that would degrade. Getting a little bit into the weeds there, but it's an important concept to understand. Particularly as we look closer at these precursors, there's some of the most important families of precursors are mentioned here. These may include the perfluoroalkyl sulfonamides. These are one group of precursors that are considered perfluorinated, it's the sulfonamide group that can partially break down and may form PFSAs or PFCAs. Again, recalling that the PFSAs and PFCAs, those are subcategories of those perfluoroalkyl acids or PFAAs. Within the polyfluoroalkyl substances, some of the most well-known, widely analyzed precursor compounds are of these fluorotelomer types. So you may recall the fluorotelomer alcohol that we showed in the previous slides. There are analogous compounds that include a sulfonate group or a carboxylate group. And all of these are similar in that they may partially transform and ultimately form, in this case, PFCAs. They aren't as susceptible to forming PFSAs. Perfluoroalkyl, sulfonamido ethanols, and acetic acids are other categories. So a couple items to note here before moving on. Most of these precursors mentioned in the slide are included in the EPA's 1633 method. I think all in the slide except for the fluorotelomer alcohols would be included in that analysis. A typical analysis will provide some data on precursors present. However, this is a relatively small number of the literally thousands of potential precursors that could be present within a given environmental sample. A final concept we need to mention related to the chemistry of PFAS is the idea of replacement chemistry. As PFOS, PFOA, and many of the related precursors have been phased out of production in many Western nations. Chemical companies have sought replacement chemistries for these compounds. A lot of the replacement chemicals have involved producing more shorter chain as opposed to the longer chain compounds. But some additional chemical structures have also been produced and used. Generally, these replacement compounds are newer in the market, have often more limited information in terms of toxicity and physical chemical properties. One possible exception to that is the compound HFPODA, which is sometimes referred to as Gen X, which was a processing aid technology. It's been produced and used. This is one that has gotten additional regulatory attention, including a proposed MCL and health-based water concentration at a relatively low level of 10 parts per trillion. Chemical structure is shown here at the bottom of the screen for a couple of these representative replacement compounds. And as you can see, having an oxygen inserted into the chemical structure is a way to turn it into something different than the parent compound that's being replaced. All right, so now we can move away from the chemistry and talk more about the history and use of PFAS before we step on into our next section here. PFAS were invented all the way back in the 1930s, even had a role in the Manhattan Project during the 1940s. But it was in the 1950s where commercial production really took off, becoming more and more widely used in many consumer products. A lot of non-stick and stain-resistant materials became more fashionable at that time. Also, in the mid-1960s is when the U.S. military adopted PFAS as the firefighting foam of choice. They specified that firefighting foam for Class B flammable liquid type firefighting would contain PFAS. And since that time, it became commercial standard to use PFAS-containing foams for extinguishing these Class B type fires. So over the course of this manufacturing timeline of PFAS in the early years, there was really only one manufacturer using a single process, electrochemical fluorination. Beginning in the 1970s, more manufacturers began to get into the PFAS production market. More manufacturing techniques became available. Fluorotelomerization was a new technique that came on board. The different techniques provide different fingerprints of PFAS, and that's something we'll talk more about in the training today, is how the formulations have changed and how that can be used in terms of identifying and fingerprinting for PFAS. So over these years, the production has changed, the uses have changed. It was beginning in the early 2000s that certain challenges, certain environmental issues, health-related issues with certain PFAS compounds became apparent, and some of the replacement compounds, such as we discussed on the previous slide, began to become more widely produced. In terms of health and the environment, really in the 1960s and early 70s, as a lot of environmental concerns were becoming apparent, some of the early health impacts of PFAS also became noted initially. It was really in the early 2000s where the interest really took off to a very different level in terms of our understanding and improving analytical methods to be able to detect PFAS down to the low levels of concern. So where things currently stand right now, we're in the 2020s, and seemingly it feels that we're seeing this entire timeline of developments compressed into every single year as things move forward. So we're on a very different trajectory than things were over the course of this multi-decade development timeline. Widespread PFAS reduction in use has inevitably led to multiple exposure pathways, which are summarized here and will also be discussed in more detail by Sandra in the upcoming fate and transport section. Where PFAS have been produced for industrial processes, in terms of both direct production and then indirect use as part of other processes, use in manufacturing and industrial processes. These have led to scenarios where there's been direct occupational exposure through perhaps inhalation or ingestion. A lot of these industrial processes have also led to a discharge through various means, through air or water discharge or solid disposal through landfills, which have ultimately led to environmental occurrence of these PFAS compounds. PFAS in consumer products has also led to direct exposure to humans through non-occupational exposures. And also in consumer products, through waste and disposal has also led to environmental occurrence. The dashed line is intended to indicate a lesser source, but still prevalent. A lot of these different sources ultimately circle back to potential for non-occupational exposures. For instance, environmental occurrence, a lot of these different pathways can lead to PFAS impacts to groundwater that could ultimately then be used for drinking water, leading to potential exposure. Environmental occurrence could also involve surface water impacts that might lead to sediments and then ultimately fish becoming contaminated by PFAS that could be consumed. So two of many different pathways through which exposure can occur. And we'll talk more about this as we go through our training today. Well, so the logical next question here is where are PFAS used and what are the sources? One of the most widespread and well-known uses of PFAS is as aqueous film-forming foam, or AFFF. These are the firefighting foams used for Class B flammable liquid type fires. And the reason they're so widely used is that they're incredibly effective. Look at the videos of using a PFAS-containing foam to extinguish Class B fires, and they work. They work incredibly well. Although non-fluorinated foams are now coming online that are hopefully going to get to the point where they will be able to compete in terms of performance. But because of their widespread use over multiple decades, PFAS-containing AFFF firefighting foams have been widely used at military installations, civilian airports, petroleum handling facilities, areas that handle large volumes of flammable liquids. The types of areas that we may look at for these include training areas where these foams may have been deployed repeatedly in the same area multiple times over decades, and then also incident response areas, also storage areas, other areas where they may be transported and used. In terms of industrial uses, PFAS are widely used in quite a number of industries. This can range from primary manufacturing, where PFAS are directly produced, to several other industries that that PFAS may support, including plastics, chrome plating, electronics industries such as photolithography, semiconductors, textiles, leather, paper, carpet. This is a short list. There's several other industries that may use PFAS at various levels, and the use of PFAS in these industries can ultimately lead to their discharge into the environment, directly or indirectly, sometimes through wastewater discharge or through the air. The two types of sources on the right-hand side are different from those on the left-hand side. These are not sources that would directly use PFAS-containing compounds, but they may be concentration points. These are areas where PFAS that may have been used elsewhere could ultimately be disposed of and then become discharged into the environment. Within landfills, PFAS have been so widely used in many products, including both consumer products and industrial waste, biocells, wastewater treatment plants that ultimately have ended up in landfills, that can ultimately lead to PFAS becoming present in landfill leachate or even in landfill gas. Similarly, wastewater treatment plants don't directly use PFAS-related compounds, but because of the widespread uses of PFAS, they may be present in wastewater streams that are discharged to a treatment plant. And wastewater treatment plant, what the wastewater treatment process does not directly remove PFAS. It may lead to partial transformation of some precursors that may be present in an influent stream, but we don't expect standard wastewater treatment processes to have a meaningful impact in terms of reducing total PFAS concentrations. Beyond the conventional PFAS uses noted on the previous slide, there are several potential PFAS sources getting some attention. This shows a few of these potential sources. Relatively short list. There are others out there certainly as well, so this isn't an exhaustive list. And I would refer you to Table 2.7 in the guidance document for additional information related to any of these and some additional sources. But some that have been getting attention include cosmetics and personal care products, which may have include PFAS to increase durability and water resistance of certain products. Fluorinated HDPE plastic containers is another area that's received some attention recently. There's a fluorination process for these plastic containers that's conducted to enhance the chemical permeation resistance of these chemicals. Doesn't directly involve PFAS, but it can indirectly produce some PFAS compounds. And these fluorinated plastic containers have been associated with some recent detections of PFAS in pesticides and other types of chemicals. Worth noting here is that the EPA has just published an analytical method related to PFAS in these HDPE containers. Food packaging, another area that's gotten significant attention. The PFAS presence in food packaging is well documented at this point. In March 2022, there was an article in Consumer Reports that evaluated PFAS presence in several types of food packaging, including wrappers and plates, bowls, and bags. Synthetic turf is another area that has received some media attention. There are some published studies related to synthetic turf in which results have been a bit more mixed. Now, as a final thought related to PFAS and the path forward, as information grows regarding presence of PFAS, there is growing progress being made towards limiting or restricting PFAS in consumer products. And as you may have seen, a small but growing number of states are also considering or have enacted legislation to limit or ban PFAS in consumer products. Also, there are several labels or certifications related to reduction or elimination of PFAS in products that are now exist in the marketplace. This table shows a summary of some of these labels, and I would refer you again to the guidance document, Table 2.8, which from which this table is pulled, and this provides the table in the guidance document provides web links. If you'd like more information on any of these, I'd refer you to that. But very briefly, the EPA Sustainable Marketplace provides an overview, a comprehensive list of product labels, some of which are related to PFAS. The FDA's website provides an overview of products that are authorized to use PFAS for certain categories related to food contact. There are several organizations that have various types of PFAS labels as well, which are summarized here. In general, there's not a standard approach for certifying products as PFAS compliant or PFAS free at this point, but it's an evolving system. These typically allow some minimum level of PFAS to be present, and they might include labels such as PFAS free, PFOA free, or fluorine free. So again, I'd refer you to Table 2.8 for additional information related to these. Now that ends this introductory section, and I will pass the mic on to Shailene to talk about AFFF.
Thank you, Mitch. I appreciate it. Let's see if I have access. Move it forward. Great. Oops, moved it too forward. There we go. All right, so I'm Shalene Thomas. I'm with Battelle. I'm going to spend the next 10 to 15 minutes furthering your alphabet soup, lunch, or dinner, or whatever time of day it is for you, to talk through AFFF. Within our technical regulatory guidance document, we have Chapter 3, which is dedicated to firefighting foams. And I just want to make note of two tables that are there that we hope to update. But they are AFFF characteristics and AFFF transition to fluorine-free foam. So in that characteristics table, what we've tried to do is identify different types of AFFF that are both from military use or other use perspective. What the type of foam is, the category and subcategory, which I will get into so you can learn all about that. What the product mixture contains as far as it relates to PFAS. And then if it's certified through a mil-spec or otherwise, as well as links to the manufacturer name and location and notes. The transition table does have examples of where AFFF foam has been transitioned to fluorine-free foam, the criteria that was used for selection of the new product, alternatives selected, if there was any replacement versus clean out, if they used any type of sampling protocol, types of cleaning reagents, what they did with waste and other. We don't have a whole lot of examples there, but we hope to update that table and get more information out to everyone. So just as Mitch did a really great job talking about how not all PFAS are created equal, from a persistence, bioaccumulative, toxic, and structural perspective, not all firefighting foams are created equal. So what this table does in the primary message here, oops, sorry, I think I'm off. I zoomed ahead. There we go. There we go. Okay. So what this table does show is that within all types of foams, there's Class A foams and Class B foams. Class A foams are really for fighting wildfires, used for structural fires. They do not have any intentionally added PFAS. Class B foams are those that are used for hydrocarbon-based fuel fires. So that's all flammable and combustible liquids and gases, petroleum greases, tars oils, gasoline, etc. These are the ones that may contain PFAS. Within all Class B world of foams, you see on the left-hand side, those that contain PFAS and are synthetic, those that are fluorine-free and do not contain PFAS. What ITRC has focused on is that first box on the left-hand side, the aqueous film-forming foam. We are going to break down and talk quickly about the three different types of foam within this category: the legacy PFOS AFFF, legacy fluorotelomer AFFF, and modern fluorotelomer AFFF. We'll get into that here next. All right, advance. There we go. All right. So here, we're just going to go through right now the classifications of firefighting foam. So legacy PFOS, AFFF, and I'm using these terms. These are terms that were developed by ITRC to help the environmental community understand AFFF better. They are not terms that are generally used by the fire user community. So a firefighter likely is not going to say, I have legacy PFOS, AFFF. They may call it C8 as an example, or fluorotelomer foam they may call C6. So take note of that. But these are ways to better describe what we're dealing with for the environmental perspective. So legacy PFAS AFFF was manufactured using electrochemical fluorination. Its short term is ECF. So this ECF chemistry is extremely complex. It contains a homologous series, pardon me, anywhere from 2 carbons to 13 carbons. It's generally from 3M, manufactured by 3M. There are both branched and linear isomers associated with this firefighting foam. The ratio generally is around 30 to 70%. And you see mostly, going back to Mitch's chemistry lesson, the perfluorosulfonic acids are PFSAs. The legacy fluorotelomer compounds, they contain more polyfluorinated PFAS that can then transform to perfluorocarboxylic acids, or the PFCAs. So not the sulfonate products, but rather the carboxylic acid products. They do not contain PFOS, and they cannot transform to PFOS. So generally, the fluorotelomers are those that are identified. They're not listed in the UCMR method, so it's important to take note of that. The modern fluorotelomer AFFFs, those were developed in response to PFOA and PFOS phase out. They've been around more recently in the last 20 years. They are the ones that are called C6 because they contain the shorter PFAS compounds and may have trace amounts of PFOA. And they also do transform in the environment to PFCAs. Let's try this slide advancement that I'm struggling with here. There we go. Okay. So next, I just wanted to stress what an AFFF concentrate composition looks like. I think it's very important. I think when you first get into this, you're thinking, oh, I have this huge 55-gallon drum and it's all PFAS firefighting foam. That is definitely not the case. So all AFFF products contain surfactant solvents and additives. I'm giving an example here of a 3% concentrate solution. As you can see, the concentrate solution is mostly water or diluent, and AFFF generally contains as much as 18% of surfactants, but of those surfactants, only about 2% of them are actual fluorosurfactants that contain the PFAS component. AFFF does get concentrated commercially available in 1-3-6% solution. Generally, you see 3-6% solutions, but keep note of that when you are considering AFFF in your PFAS challenges. Next slide here. All right, so next we'll talk about AFFF and the mixtures of AFFF. As I said, not all PFAS are created equal. Not all AFFF is created equal. Even looking within the different formulations, they are also not all created equal. So there have been two main types of the manufacturing for AFFF, as I mentioned, ECF and fluorotelomerization. So ECF is that legacy PFOS product. Fluorotelomerization is the legacy and modern PFOA product. ECF produced branched and linear isomers, and fluorotelomerization produces linear isomers only. So each type of foam does have a distinct isomer signature that has not only changed over time, but it really varies between manufacturer. The foams have been and continue to be really complex mixtures of PFAS. As illustrated by these pie charts, you can see the formulations ranged in composition from the legacy AFFFs containing perfluoroalkyl acids, or PFAAs, and the fully fluorinated PFAS, including PFSAs, or perfluorosulfonic acids, composition, as well as PFCAs, or perfluorocarboxylic acids. You see those in the newer foams. So the two on the left-hand side are the electrochemical fluorination, how their composition is mostly the PFSA, how that composition changed from 89 and moving forward, and then the fluorotelomerization product being mostly PFCA. All right, so now we'll just get into a little bit around the mechanisms for application of release to the environment. The top three takeaways here I want you to understand is when AFFF is introduced into the environment, it's released not just as a concentrate, but potentially as a foam. So that 3%, 6% solution actually means it's 3% of the concentrate and 97% water added. AFFF is applied by mixing the concentrate with the water. The foam solution is then aerated at a nozzle, and then it's really released, and then that's when it can contaminate soil, surface water, groundwater, and potentially co-contaminants are often present because you are fighting fire. Now, let's talk a little bit about some of the release mechanisms that can result in AFFF related to PFAS impacts to the environment. So these can include unplanned low volume releases of the foam concentrate from a foam distribution piping, storage tank, rail car, storage area during operational activities. You can also have moderate volume releases of foam solution, those that can occur accidentally or planned discharges during equipment testing or episodic releases. We know now mostly across the US, any type of testing does avoid mostly the AFFF discharges or releases. Planned releases during firefighting operations can be from a moderate volume discharge during routine operation or broadcast high volume discharge. And that's the case during a firefighting emergency response. So consider that as you evaluate any site that has AFFF. We'll just move now quickly touching base on AFFF fate and transport. I can advance the slide. There we go. All right. So with regards to AFFF fate and transport, it's used to address potential risk development of a conceptual site model and identification of treatment options. So once AFFF has been released to the environment, fate and transport data are used to identify the chemical transformation, the migration pathway of those AFFF constituents. So this information is really critical when you're trying to do site-specific conceptual models. And then those are used to guide your investigation programs by either human health, ecological risk assessment, ultimately remedy selection, design, and cleanup. The chemical and structural properties that play key roles in behavior in the environment include chain lengths, which Mitch talked about a little bit, ionic states and charges, types and functional groups, and extent of fluorination. So precursors that may be in the original AFFF formulation are transformed via abiotic processes such as hydrolysis, photolysis, oxidation. And while PFAS are not biodegradable, biodegradation of precursors can, in fact, as Mitch identified, produce PFAAs such as PFOA. So there's relative high solubilities of most PFAS found in AFFF that contributes to the migration rates. Sandra will be talking more about fate and transport a little bit later on, so I'll let her continue on to that topic. All right, so now I want to get into more of the fire user and firefighting foam side. So with procurement and inventory, what are the best management practices? The next series of slides really touch base on this. As illustrated in the graphic on the top right, AFFF and specifically PFAS have the potential to cause harm, obviously. That's why we're all here. Therefore, that's considered a hazard. However, the risk or the chance that someone may be harmed by the hazard is only probable if exposure exists. So these best management practices really recognizing AFFF will be in transition for some time to come. We want to consider the end users and what they need to do. So the key things are in foam selection to document all your procurement and inventory of foam that you have. Understand the performance specification requirements, which I will touch on, whether they are mill specified requirements, UL standards, or otherwise. Understand the concentrate mixtures and the percent solution in water, as well as foam storage and handling. So the best management practices in storage and handling, where you have the storage, what volumes you have, if you have fire trucks or suppression systems, and ensuring proper secondary containment to avoid spills and mishaps. I think for the most part, a lot of this is already taken care of, I think, with now the familiarity with PFAS and AFFF. Next, we'll move into treatment and disposal. So with regards to treatment and disposal, the best management practices suggest that all AFFF foam concentrate volume be fully accounted for at each location, from your trucks to your suppression systems to your storage tanks. EPA did come out in December of 2020 with an interim guidance on destroying and disposing PFAS and PFAS-containing materials. They are expected any day now to publish a revised guidance. And so we're waiting for that to see if there is anything new. But fire and flush water really containing AFFF should be disposed of as a generated waste whenever possible. PFAS in the water can be processed to concentrate PFAS prior to disposal. The concentrated waste then can be incinerated per APA. EPA can be landfilled or stabilized or deep well injected as an option. Another option that EPA put in that document was to store in place until better options come out. There are new technologies that are coming on the market to destroy PFAS. So those are often used in conjunction with some of the disposal and concentration solutions. All right, next slide. So next, talking about firefighting foam and foam system replacement. There's two points for fixed systems. There's no drop-in replacement for firefighting foams that are MIL-SPEC certified. So in this case, there's going to be some changes and discrepancies associated with engineering and maybe some engineering design requirements. So you really have to consider what the performance specs, system modifications, and decontamination and disposal requirements are. Considering your clean out and replacement options, looking at the age of the system to determine, is it more cost effective to replace the system versus attempt to clean it out and dispose of the contaminated waste. You really want to consider alternatives when you're using fire foam for specific hazards. Are there substitutions that are not regrettable where you don't need, in fact, firefighting foam? Water mist, dry chemical. There's containment flooring systems now that have been developed and are commercialized, as well as separation and exposure protection for your employees and your assets. So factors to consider really are, what are the current performance requirements of the foam? What application techniques are anticipated, and how clean does the system need to be in the future? That's a controversial topic I will touch on here for a moment. So really trying to understand how clean is clean really is determined by regulatory bodies. I think state regulators are at the preface of that in determining proper process and procedure. So last slide here, as it relates to research and development, this topic really continues to evolve both in understanding historical and current AFFF, as well as finding suitable replacements that are not regrettable substitutions and being able to safely transition to them. So in 2023, the DOD did release a fluorine-free foam MIL-SPEC. That MIL-SPEC is fluorine-free. However, it is permitted to have unintentionally added PFAS in it. This is the MIL-SPEC that is being used by both Department of Defense as well as FAA. Other industrial users, other municipal users are not required to use this, and there are other fluorine-free foam alternatives that are available to them. So if you do want to look at any research that's out there currently going on with as it relates to firefighting foam alternatives and products, or AFFF in the environment, I suggest you go to CertIP and ESTCP. And with that, I will transition it over to Sandra to talk about freight and transport. Thank you.
Thank you, Shailene. So much amazing content so far. I hope everybody's staying with us. I am going to take you through the fate and transport and a little bit into site characterization. So I'm taking a lot of the concepts that Mitch Olson presented in the chemistry to give you some application, a little bit of repetition, so the important points sink in, and then applying it to why those characteristics matter. There we go. All right. I'm going to try to keep it at a very high level because this can get very detailed. But the technical regulatory document, guidance document, has a lot of amazing information. We've really pulled from the literature to give you the top current science on these issues, so that you can find the PFAS guidance document at the homepage, the PFAS-1 homepage on the ITRC.org web. And you'll find discussions of these concepts in various sections. So, as Mitch was discussing, Section 2 talked about the sources and releases. Section 4 is the physical and chemical properties, really getting into that. And there's a great accompanying table of physical and chemical properties in one of the external tables that has all well many of the literature values that have been presented from field studies or laboratory studies, coming up with some kind of estimate of these chemical properties to serve as information on understanding them a little better. Section 5 is all about fate and transport. Section 2 is all about occurrence in the environment, and Section 10 talks about site characterization, so really applying this and understanding your site. A little bit of repetition from what Mitch introduced. The major sources that we're talking about, or that really kind of give us concern, is the fire training or fire response site, so what Shailene was talking about, and that's the release of that Class B AFFF. So like I said, it could be done where they train to put out fires, or where they're responding to a fire, or if there's any leaks or other releases. Another major source is industrial sites. So facilities that either use PFAS in their process, or they're actually making the chemical PFAS. Those are the top two, and they have multiple ways of releasing this. If there's no treatment on their effluent discharge or their emissions, there's the potential for release to the environment. And the other two are landfills and wastewater treatment plants. And it's not because they use the PFAS, but it's because they accumulate it or aggregate it at their site. And then there's the potential for release to the environment. So to understand these sources, you begin to understand maybe what chemical compounds are present. Like Shailene said, there are specific chemistries when you're discussing AFFF. So get to know your release and get to know the products used and what PFAS may be more prevalent at those sources, and you kind of begin your entry into fate and transport. So what is fate and transport? It really is an understanding of how a contaminant will migrate through the environment and ultimately where it will have its impacts. Broadly speaking, the major determinants of that migration and impact will have to do with the chemical properties and the site properties, as discussed here. So the chemical properties of PFAS are very unique, or just unique. As Mitch described, a lot of what we are concentrating on right now has to do with perfluoroalkyl acids. Remember, those are the PFAS, where you have that fully fluorinated tail and you have a head group. What you're looking at here is PFOS that you may have heard about, widely studied, because we know there's been a lot of PFOS releases to the environment, and we understand the toxicity of it, or we understand it because a lot of people have studied it. So perfluoroalkyl acids are extremely persistent in the environment. That carbon fluorine bond is very strong. That's not readily going to break down under environmental conditions. So it remains very persistent in the environment. And perfluoroalkyl acids will preferentially partition at interfaces. Because of that chemical structure, you have the head group that tends to be, it may be rejecting water or lipids, but it is very soluble. So the head group wants to be in the liquid in the aqueous phase, and the tail wants to stick out. So that's why we're saying it preferentially partitions at that air-water interface, or at interfaces in general. So we have the perfluoroalkyl acids that we have begun to understand, but just keep in mind that there are thousands, and those implications of a different structure is going to impact how it migrates, how it travels in the environment. So you have your functional group, but functional groups can change. We understand the functional groups in the perfluoroalkyl acids to be primarily sulfonic acids or carboxylic acids, and we kind of understand how they differentiate themselves. But when you're looking at structural chemistries that are not fully fluorinated, you may have other elements in that compound that changes how that chemistry reacts in the environment. And you also want to understand if you have a part of it that is fully fluorinated and a part that's not, you may have the ability of that structure to transform in the environment. And the concern is that with that fully fluorinated portion of the chain, that transformation could lead to those more recalcitrant, the real persistent perfluoroalkyl acids. So that transformation has to be understood. So just in general for PFAAs, it's worth mentioning again, that head group, it starts out, you're saying it's a carboxylic acid or a sulfonic acid, but at typical environmental pHs, which are 4 to 10, that acid is deprotonated, that hydrogen's gone. So you're talking about you're having a negative charge. So you have an anion, and that anion makes that compound a lot more water soluble. This is also why they act really good as surfactants. They have that ability to decrease the surface tension between the two liquids. Now, typically also they have low vapor pressure and Henry's law coefficients, meaning you're not going to assume that they're going to be volatile in their state, like at typical concentrations. If they're in the soil, you're not going to expect a lot of volatilization out of the soil. That's perfluoroalkyl acids. There are other PFAS that you may see some higher volatility, but typically PFAAs are not going to have a lot of volatility at typical environmental conditions. If you have them under manufacturing conditions at high temperatures or high stack speeds releasing from a manufacturing stack, that's different. That changes their atmospheric transport. So just to give you an idea of like the differences, just talking about some basic perfluoroalkyl acids, this table gives you a summary of how they might transport in the environment. So we've discussed how the head group can make them more soluble, but they're not going to transport along with the water perfectly. There's going to be some retardation or some sorption onto the components, whether it be in the vadus zone or in the groundwater, they're going to kind of lag behind that groundwater. And that has to do with partitioning to organic carbon and other properties that you find in the geochemistry of your site. So organic carbon is just one characteristic of your site that you need to consider. And this table is a summary that shows you how the organic carbon might retard it with its retardation factor and how they relate in magnitude to each other. So the top compounds that you see in the red print there are going from the four carbon chain PFBA to the PFUNA, which has 11 carbons in it. And you'll see that the longer the chain is, the more it is retained, the more it is retarded. So it's going to be moving a lot slower. The perfluorobutanoic acid is very soluble, so it's going to move more with the water and only have a little bit of retardation. When you get into the sulfonic acids, the same thing exists for the chain. So the longer the chain is, the more retardation you're going to get. But when you compare the sulfonic acids to the carboxylic acids, the sulfonic acids are going to have a higher level of retardation on the material that they're going to move through. So they're going to partition at interfaces that may further slow the transport. These interactions are very complex, especially when there is something else present, when there's a triple F present, when there's NAPL present. You're going to really find that that differential transport is going to be important to understand for your site characterization. So we talked about precursors. That's another thing you're going to have to consider, is that your releases, if it started out as a potential precursor to a perfluoral alkyl acid, over time, if it has the ability to transform into one of those recalcitrant perfluoral alkyl acids, it's really good to understand that. So understanding your source, understanding the product that came from the source, and potentially investigating that as the plume changes, or as the plume is aging or moving, it can be very important. And just as an aside, so it's not just these fluorotelomer alcohols or very evident one. There's a lot of different PFAS that have the ability to transform in the environment, and some we don't know about yet. So this is really much an area of investigation. There's even some polymers, some particularly side chain polymers, that may degrade in the environment, maybe over very long periods of time. This is really a discussion, could be contentious, but there's under a lot of investigation, and that's something that we have to understand more. So something that you might consider at a site. All right, I'm going to take you through PFAS occurrence in environmental media, really make you think of these concepts as they apply. PFAS can be found in any of these media. They're going to travel through it. There's lots of different mechanisms, lots of different PFAS, but lots of different mechanisms that they're going to be partitioning into these different categories. So it's going to be in the air, soil, groundwater, surface water, sediment, biota. I could add to that vegetation. It's going to move through environmental media. We'll give you kind of just an overview of just high-level concepts. Atmospheric transport. This could be regional or global scale. This is really significant to think about. The sources could be stack emissions, incineration, fire suppression, anywhere that's going to really kind of get it into the atmosphere. Like I spoke of before, it doesn't have to be volatile to get into the air. It could be that there are some precursors that are volatile. They would easily get into the atmosphere. And those precursors may transform into PFAAs. When they're going to transform, unclear. Maybe, different environmental conditions would change them. Atmospheric conditions would change them. But a lot of these are going to not just be transported by themselves, but they're going to be transported via aerosols or particulates. So if you have stack emissions with a lot of particulates from a facility that is using or manufacturing PFAS, those particulates or any of those aerosols that are released through stack emissions that go untreated could be causing a source that has have these PFAS migrate to large areas. So atmospheric deposition, kind of think of it, it could have the potential to have large impacted areas around industrial sites. Now, transport in the vadose zone. The PFAS could be released to the soil. It could be deposited from atmospheric emissions, and then move through the vadose zone. And you see all the different processes that could take place there in that little purple circle. You have partitioning onto the soil. You have uptake, whether it's into biota or vegetation, and transformation. So whatever is released, if it is that final perfluoroalkyl acids, that's going to remain there. That's going to move there. That's not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere. It's not changing in chemistry, but it's migrating as that chemical component. So that leaching then into the groundwater. As I said, there's low volatility for most PFAS once it hits the soil, but that doesn't mean you need to take it out of contention or out of consideration. You need to understand your source and the PFAS that are present in the source. And then as this moves through the soil, even though there's partitioning and a lot can remain in the soils for a long period of time, it's could just provide a very low level of leaching to the groundwater, which provides a very long-term source to the groundwater. And I'm sure you have an idea that it's really only low levels in the groundwater that begin to cause concern. So even though it's slow, if it's there, it could be a continual source. So this could remain important. Once it's in the groundwater, we kind of go back to what we were talking about before. How is it going to travel? Are there other contaminants there? What is the soil like? What is the hydrogeology like? The geochemistry? You really have to kind of consider how that is going to impact retardation or transformation. And the impacts of remedial activities or biotransformation, if there's already something occurring on the site, if you're creating an oxidation issue, that may serve to transform the PFAS at a higher rate than you were expecting. So, things to consider. And again, differential transport, you may find it, a certain chemical in one place and not find it in another place because it's being held back. So the different compounds are going to partition and travel, migrate at different rates. This is a great picture. It kind of gives you an overall concept of fate and transport on an AFFF site. So you have your source site that has the AFFF release, and this one also contains a petroleum release. So you have a high concentration of the contaminants close to the release site. Usually is not very well oxygenated, so it's anaerobic and has reducing conditions. As that moves away from the source, you're going to get more oxygen into it, which is going to allow the potential for biotransformation to the perfluoroalkyl acids. The hydrocarbons are starting to degrade rapidly in this more oxidizing conditions. And as you move even further away, you have a smaller fraction of the precursors. So if your AFFF started out as mostly precursors to perfluoroalkyl acids, as you're getting further away, you're really seeing those perfluoroalkyl acids. They're fully transformed, and that's your problem at that spot. And if you have any short chains that were released in the initial product, then those are going to be kind of moving in front of everything else. Those are more soluble, so they're going to be kind of at the leading edge of the plume. So Just a couple of issues to wrap up. This is a lot of information. Take what you learned from Mitch, try to apply it to the concepts here. And then a couple of additional issues that are relevant that you might want to consider. The science is evolving fast. Regulations are evolving fast. Regulations are hopefully using the science, keeping up with it to be protective. So keep an eye on the most recent science, understand your product and your chemistries, and apply it. Analytical methods are so important. Christy will go through the analytical methodologies, but you can only do something about what you know about. The analytical methodologies have really led the explosion of, the our ability to address this problem. As Mitch said, it was really not until the 2000s where we had the sensitive analytical methodologies in place. And they're still changing now. We're understanding what we don't know, what we need to be able to quantify. And the regulatory environment, it's changing, but like I said, hopefully it's changing with the science, and keeping it up there. So keeping in front of it there. Other issues, if you didn't get this, groundwater is very significant due to its source as drinking water. Drinking water is really the impact that is a very important impact. If there's, you may know that you get exposed to PFAS in various ways. So you can have it in, your food. But if it's in your drinking water, even if it's at a little bit over the levels that are recommended, that becomes a significant source. That's what's leading the exposure. So drinking water is very important. The plumes where releases have been released, they can be quite extensive. So being able to characterize that and understand how they're moving is very important. I mean, you really need to understand the history of the site. So think of this, going back decades. Think of the products that could have been used and released. Think of the time and what's going to happen to those products based on the chemistry of the chemical and of the conditions of the site. And realize that it's widespread use. So there's potential for multiple releases in a given area or off-site contributions. And there may be atypical sources present too. So an atypical source may be where there was some PFAS-containing material that was just moved to a different site and deposited there. So you're saying, why is this contaminated here? And you find out that this is where the facility that treated materials for water. For water being waterproof. Maybe they just dumped their biosolids, their waste at a certain site, not really thinking that that was a problem. So that's an atypical source. You just have to kind of consider possible, why you would have different releases. Know that you have complex transitions between media. So between the vadose zone, the groundwater and the surface water interactions, remember that surfactant kind of properties that are going to have that preferential deposition there and partitioning. So there's sorption through all types of mechanisms, hydrophobic, electrostatic, and interphase partitioning mechanisms. Here we go. Oh dear. So sorry. Okay. So yeah, I think this is our question period.
It is indeed. Thank you very much, Sandra. Just taking back remote control for a moment there. All right. So at this time, we are going to look to answer some questions from our audience to our trainers. I'm going to jump right in just to be conscious of time. So our first question, how is the chain length of a PFAA determined?
I'll let Mitch take that one. Yep.
Hi there. Yep, I can speak to that. Okay, the chain length of a PFAA. The chain length is the length of the fluorinated carbon portion of the molecule for the purpose of the PFAAs in particular. It also includes that the carbon that's associated with that carboxyl acid group as well. So we think of PFOS as an example of a sulfonate, eight carbons and then a sulfonate group on the end. For the related compound PFOA, there's seven fluorinated compounds plus the carbon that's part of the carboxyl acid group. But since that's the terminal product and it's not going to degrade further, that's counted as part of the chain length as well. And in terms of the precursors, it's the carbonate, it's that fluorinated portion of the carbon that would be considered when thinking of the chain length.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Mitch. Pausing here just to see if any other trainers have anything to add. All right, next question. How are fluorine-free foams tested or defined?
I'll take that one. So in terms of definition, fluorine-free foams are really driven by the performance specification and their use. So for mil-spec 32725, this is the fluorine-free foam that was based on the mil-spec provided by the Navy, and that works for both the Department of Defense and their use of fluorine-free foam, as well as FAA Part 139 airports. So these are, I think, around 600 airports or so around the US. There are other specification requirements for other industries and other uses. So, as an example, internationally, there's the International Civil Aviation Organization and certifications there. In terms of how fluorine-free is defined within those specifications, that can also range. So here in the US, the new mil-spec that is fluorine-free foam for all of DoD and FAA users, it is defined by no intentionally added PFAS, as well as a maximum of one part per billion PFAS that is unintentionally added, that may be unintentionally added and found in the mixture. And they use EPA Method 1633. For other types of foams, however, there's a green screen, which was mentioned early on in the presentation by Mitch. They have, I think, almost four dozen products now that are fluorine-free foams for Class B. They identify fluorine-free as not intentionally added PFAS and no more than one part per million total organic fluorine. So they use a different method and evaluation as to what's fluorine-free, quote, quote.
All right, thanks so much, Shailene. I'll just quickly pause here and see if any other trainers have anything to add. All right, next question. Are there any ITRC resources that identify regulatory concentrations for environmental media?
I'll take that one. There's a great resource. If you go to the homepage, you'll see where there's a series of external tables. And we have a group of people that have done an amazing job collecting states, federal, international, regulatory, and guidance values. So it's the first table that you'll come to. It's called PFAS Water and Soil Regulatory and Guidance Values. So that's just for soil and water. We've recently added a second table that goes into air values because people are starting to recognize the importance of addressing the air. So we have an amazing resource. In addition, there's content in the guidance document for you to understand typical environmental concentrations. So chapter six is all about occurrences, and 17.1 is a gathering of environmental concentrations in all the different environmental media. So you can understand typical concentrations, you can understand regulatory concentrations with the table, but some really good resources.
Thanks so much, Sandra. Again, I'll just pause quickly to see if any other trainers have anything to add. Okay. All right, next question. Can you explain what a side chain fluorinated polymer is? Can the side chain fluorinated polymers become precursors for PFAAs?
I can speak to that one. Side chain PFAS, which were noted in that family tree shown earlier in this presentation, are some of the products that involve PFAS or use PFAS in the production involve these side chain polymers, which effectively are a PFAS compound that's bound on one side to a surface. The other side is, I'll think of a grassy field that's waving in the wind or something to that effect. And the exposed end of the PFAS compound can break free, and that's part of the degradation process. The side chain polymer, the exposed portion of the PFAS could potentially break free and then become a precursor or a PFAA eventually.
All right. Thanks so much, Mitchell. I'm going to just again pause quickly to see if any other trainers want to add anything. All right. If not, we are going to move on to our next section, which is PFAS sampling and analysis, and it'll be presented by Christy Herzer, again from the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation. All
Thank you
right,
so
Christy.
much, Devin. All right, so keep those questions coming and we will try to get to as many of them as we can. So for this next part of the presentation, the material I'll be discussing can be found in section 11 of the tech reg, as well as one of the external tables I mentioned at the beginning. And that it's a spreadsheet. It has the basics as well as the specifics of the published methods. It has analyte lists and it has draft published methods. So, like Sandra just mentioned, the soil and water regulatory values table in that same list of external tables and documents, you can find this analytical methods Excel file. So for PFAS sampling events, it is important to have a quality assurance project plan, QAP, or a site-specific work plan. And this is because routine sampling plans do not adequately address PFAS-specific concerns. These plans should include PFAS-specific sampling standard operating procedures or SOPs, and that helps improve sampling consistency and overall data quality. Federal and state agencies, as well as consulting firms have developed guidelines, checklists, and SOPs, and we have a list of examples in Section 11 of the Technical Regulatory Guidance document. So, PFAS sampling is different from other sampling events due to an increased potential for contamination of your sample to occur. And what I mean by contamination is the unintentional introduction of PFAS to your sample during sample collection, shipping, or storage. There are three main reasons for this increased contamination potential. First, the extremely low PFAS regulatory criteria or screening criteria results in the concentration that defines contamination to be unusually low. Second, PFAS can exist at a sampling location at concentrations orders of magnitude higher than that screening or regulatory criteria. And because of this, there's an increased risk that routine decontamination processes will be inadequate and materials typically used for sampling, or this can cause samples to become cross-contaminated. And lastly, some sampling equipment and materials that are used for sampling events contain or they may contain PFAS. So keep in mind that we're mostly focusing on items that come into direct contact with the sample being collected. We do have a list in 11.1.2 of specific materials to avoid. In addition, you can pretest those items and/or collect equipment rinse blanks. So, when planning and preparing for a sampling event, you have to first consider what the project objectives are. Then think about the site history, because this might dictate the PFAS compounds you want to include for analysis. Also, the site history can indicate whether extremely high concentrations of PFAS may be expected in some areas, such as fire training areas. So, this information can be useful when determining the frequency of quality control samples, such as decontamination equipment blanks. Also, think about your project action levels or regulatory screening criteria. project action levels need to be considered for determining the cleanliness requirements. So this means the project's definition of PFAS-free, for which all the sampling equipment, supplies, and field quality control are going to be evaluated against. So due to all of these issues we just discussed, it is important to develop those PFAS project-specific work plans or QAPs. And again, keep those PFAS-specific sampling SOPs involved because these will help improve that sampling consistency and overall data quality. So all sampling and analysis requires communication with the lab from the beginning. Planning stage all the way through the data reporting stage. However, PFAS projects may require additional communication with respect to PFAS. This communication can include the discussion of verification requirements for sampling supplies, the analyte list, the definition of PFAS-free for the project, the need for additional sample bottles for additional quality control, the volume of sample required to achieve the laboratory reporting limits quoted for the project, and the project sample preparation requirements. In addition, the project should communicate with the lab if samples are suspected to contain very high concentrations of PFAS, as the concentration of PFAS in the sample often dictates the appropriate sample preparation technique to be used. Now, if you don't communicate this with the lab and the samples are prepared without this consideration, it can cause significant cross-contamination issues during sample prep and contaminate the analytical instrumentation. As you might expect, this will cause extensive delays in sample analysis and potentially affect the data usability. So, to determine if the sampling equipment and materials could contain PFAS, make sure to review any appropriate safety data sheets, SDSs, and product specification documents to determine if any sort of PFAS or fluoropolymer content may be indicated. But keep in mind, even if it's not listed on the SDS, it does not completely assure that a material is PFAS-free. So, in the absence of confident information, you can perform testing of the materials prior to any sampling event to vet the potential for any impacts to your sampling event. A good rule of thumb is when in doubt, check it out. So collect equipment blanks and extra quality control samples and or have your lab test the material prior to your sampling event. Also, as a part of the coordination that should be performed with your lab is to assure the entire container used to collect the sample will be used for extraction and analysis as defined by each of the EPA methods. Therefore, even if a lab requests 500 milliliters of water per sample, if the method such as 537.1 or 533 uses 250 milliliters for analysis, this necessitates the collection of two containers of 250 milliliters each. So some of the supplies needed for your sampling event do need to be supplied by the laboratory that is performing the analysis. These include sample containers, solvents used in decontamination processes, water used for blanks in the field, and the final rinse of equipment. The lab must verify that these samples are PFAS-free, as defined by the project, prior to shipping them into the field and provide the project with the documentation of that verification. Now, if for some reason site water or other water other than the water that's supplied by the laboratory is used in the field for any blanks or a final rinse of the equipment, so all right, just send a sample of this water into the laboratory for analysis. So when using reusable equipment in the field, again, a close review of the SDS for soaps and detergents to be used for field decontamination is important. So, any soap or detergent that contains proprietary fluorosurfactants should be avoided. And in fact, the recommendation is actually to use soaps that have previously been used or tested. So, even if the soap or detergent that is used does not contain fluorosurfactants, some knowledge of the container that the soaps or detergents are contained in can be important. So, if you have large or heavy equipment, it's most likely too expensive and inconvenient to only use that PFAS-free water. So, you can decon that at a facility, or you can use site water for the bulk of the decontamination and then use that PFAS-free water for the final rinse. So ultimately, the QAP created for the site and sampling bench should fully describe the field quality control needed to fulfill and complement the quality control necessary. However, if the sampling event involves a mix of non-potable water methods and drinking water methods, then you do need to make sure that the additional requirements of the drinking water methods are met, such as the frequency of field reagent blanks, the use of field duplicates, and the frequency of matrix spikes. If the drinking water analyses are for samples that could be used or considered for compliance, the omission of some of these additional criteria could invalidate the sample data that is generated. So, with all of the unknowns associated with PFAS sample collection and the possibility that the detection of extremely low levels of PFAS may trigger regulatory actions, it is critical to have as much quality assurance and quality control data as possible to evaluate the validity of your results. These include equipment blanks, field blanks, reagent blanks, and trip blanks. In general, you should not field filter PFAS water samples, and that's to avoid loss of PFAS onto the filter. Some good alternatives to field filtering include the use of low flow sampling techniques, and also centrifuging in the lab is a good alternative. If filters are used in the lab, they must ensure that it's rinsed with the extraction solvent during processing. So, in summary, for PFAS sampling, what really matters is what comes in contact with the sample and have a practical approach to contamination concerns. Method-specific requirements for sampling, sample preservation, shipping and holding times all vary. There are some general guidelines that exist, but PFAS-specific sampling protocols are recommended. Sampling event planning and upfront work and communication is key. So now moving on to PFAS analysis. US EPA methods 537.1 and 533, some strong similarities. Both require field reagent blanks. The sample is prepared using solid phase extraction. Both are multi-lab validated methods. They do have some differences, such as they have different chemical preservatives and collection processes required. For analysis, they have different quantitation schemes, which I'll get into in a few slides. They have different holding times and different analyte lists. As far as their analyte lists, they do have 14 PFAS compounds common to both methods, four compounds unique to 537.1 on the left, and then 11 PFAS compounds unique to 533 on the right. US EPA method 1633 was finalized in January of 2024, and this method is applicable to 40 PFAS compounds in groundwater, wastewater, surface water, leachate, biosolids, tissue, sediment, and soil. There are other finalized published methods such as EPA 1621, OTM 45, and DoD HFFF01. US EPA 1621 is the adsorbable organic fluorine may be useful for determining the presence or absence of PFAS. OTM 45 or other test method 45 is a sampling analysis technique that determines PFAS in particulate, adsorbable, and soluble phases. And DoD HFFF01 is applicable to HFFF concentrates for the determination of the concentration of PFOA and PFOS for qualification and compliance to the mil-spec. So there are some key consistencies between 537.1, 533, and 1633. All of them use liquid chromatography, tandem mass spectrometry that use analytical standards to identify and quantify individual PFAS. The analyte list for these methods do not include neutral or volatile PFAS, such as fluorotelomer alcohols. And for all of these methods, the same equipment and supply concerns associated with field sampling do apply. Now, there are some significant ways in which these methods differ that need to be considered when selecting a method. First, the scope of these methods vary greatly. So, the media that each method has been validated for varies along with the limits of detection and limits of quantitation that are achievable in each media. That also varies. The method analyte lists vary, and another significant difference is their sample preparation process and levels of sample cleanup steps included. But what I really want to focus on is the quantitation scheme utilized by each method. Now, there are three quantitation schemes possible: external standard, internal standard, and isotope dilution quantitation. And depending on the scheme used, the bias associated with the sample preparation, the instrumentation, and the matrix interference may or may not be accounted for in the quantitation of individual PFAS. So first up, with external quantitation, this does not account for any of these three biases. And then moving on to internal standard quantitation, this accounts for instrumentation bias, and EPA method 537.1 utilizes internal standard quantitation. Now, isotope dilution is the gold standard and accounts for sample preparation and instrumentation bias, as well as matrix interference, so all three. US EPA 533 and 1633 use isotope dilution quantitation. Now, without the proper review and/or validation of the data generated by any of these PFAS methods, the usability of the data cannot be evaluated. US EPA does have published guidance for the review of PFAS data from drinking water collected in accordance to 537.1. EPA also has a technical bulletin which outlines the general principles of PFAS data review. And the DoD validation guidance is also available. We have a summary of key points from these data validation guidance as an external table, again, on our ITRC website. So in recent years, a number of non-targeted analysis techniques have been developed and employed primarily by research laboratories. But with a recent increase in evaluating precursors and total fluorine, some commercial laboratories now do offer total oxidizable precursor assay or TOP assay, as well as extractable or adsorbable organic fluorine. Most of these techniques do lack published multi-laboratory validated methods. They are primarily qualitative in nature, and the results require a fair amount of interpretation. Some sites have used TOP assay to evaluate the total PFAS load on treatment systems in order to determine the proper changeout cycles for media, such as granular activated carbon. But for the most part, these techniques are considered to be mainly used as screening tools to value the total mass of fluorinated compounds at a site. So the takeaway points from the analysis portion are that while there are multiple PFAS analytical methods published, there are significant differences between them, and those differences do need to be understood and evaluated in order to ensure their use will enable the project's data quality objectives to be met. There are also lesser standardized techniques available that can be used as a qualitative or a screening tool. Just with each of these sections that we're talking about today, the presentation is a brief overview of all the information contained in the ITRC technical and regulatory guidance document, as well as the fact sheets. For a more in-depth understanding of PFAS sampling analysis, I encourage you to go to the PFAS webpage and along with all of our other content today. Like I said in the beginning, we are presenting a Beyond the Basics series later this spring and summer on multiple topics that will provide a deeper dive into this topic and more. So be on the lookout for those. And with that, I will pass it on to you, Andy.
Yeah, thank you, Christy. Okay. My name is Andy Sofolko, and I'm a senior environmental engineer at Brown and Caldwell. I co-lead the ITRC's PFAS treatment technology subgroup with my colleagues Cliff Shirk with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and Lee Wong with the California EPA. So thanks for hanging with us. It's a lot to take in. Treatment technologies will be the final section of today's training, and we will have hopefully time for one last Q&A session. The most up-to-date tech reg document is hosted on the ITRC PFAS team webpage. Treatment technologies are covered in section 12 and include a supporting treatment technology summary table that you can download, as well as a handful of case studies regarding treatment technologies that are presented in section 15.2. The ITRC treatment technology writing subgroup has defined three primary categories for evaluating treatment technologies. First, we have field-implemented technologies, which are those demonstrated at multiple locations by multiple practitioners and are well-documented in practice or the peer-reviewed literature. Second, we have limited application technologies, which may have been field implemented, but only at a limited number of sites by a limited number of practitioners, and which are generally not as well documented in the publicly available literature. And finally, we have developing technologies, which are those that have only been demonstrated at the lab or the bench scale, and typically by a limited number of research groups. And have not been widely vetted by the community of practitioners. So over time, technologies may advance from developing to limited application, and ultimately from limited application to field demonstrated. So the technological classification can change as a reflection of advances in these individual technologies development. In fact, during our most recent update to the guidance document, some technologies graduated from limited application to field implemented, and we'll make note of those as we discuss them. I mentioned in the TechReg document, as a reference and a screening tool, there's a technology summary table for PFAS treatment technologies that span the technology development spectrum. The table shown here is a part of the most recent update, which is currently published, which did represent a shift from the previous versions of the treatment technology summary table. Previously, there were two tables, one for liquids treatment, one for solids treatment. The updated table has been consolidated and reformatted with a focus on hopefully more accessibility and increased user functionality. The technologies are tabulated according to the technology's treatment mechanism, the technology's maturity, applicability to different environmental media, and include references to the applicable sections and associated case studies within the TechReg document. In the treatment technology summary table, ITRC is trying to capture the technologies that have been documented and published, but not every technology is widely discussed in the main body of the TechReg. So the summary tables in Chapter 12 are meant to help you screen and identify specific technologies that are either fully demonstrated, have limited applications, or are still under development at the laboratory or bench scale. Okay, so now we will get into a discussion of individual field implemented technologies, starting with technologies used to address PFAS impacted liquids. And really this is an intro kind of 101 training, so we will be focusing almost exclusively on field implemented technologies for today's discussion. So currently, application of effective liquid treatment technologies are all separation-based technologies. In other words, they separate and work to concentrate the PFAS from, let's say, the bulk liquid phase into either a solid phase or a lower volume liquid fraction. Many of the destructive technologies for PFAS-impacted liquids remain in the limited or developing technology categories. The section numbers here refer to where the information on each topic can be found in the web-based guidance document. Treatment objectives are critical and important drivers that can inform the selection of a particular treatment approach. But we caution and ask you to be mindful that treatment criteria are changing, and are compound PFAS compound and country or region or state specific. So getting into specific technologies here, adsorption tech, we've got starting with granular activated carbon and ion exchange media are the most commonly implemented technologies for PFAS removal in liquids because of their demonstrated effectiveness. Generally speaking, GAC, GAC, granular activated carbon, you might hear me say all of those, they're referring to the same thing. GAC has a longer deployment history, but ion exchange installations for PFAS treatment are on the rise. The design of these systems typically involves lead-lag vessel configuration, which allows for operational resiliency to continuously meet the low treatment goals often associated with PFAS compounds. We'll touch on this a little bit in the next couple of slides, but pretreatment is a key consideration when we're looking at almost all treatment technologies, particularly on the liquid side. And something that needs to be taken into account prior to implementation. Also of note is that GAC and ion exchange technologies do generate waste streams, most prominently as spent media once the adsorbent has become exhausted. And the options and cost of waste management should be taken into account and considered for life cycle cost estimates. Additionally, want to note that impending hazardous substance and other regulatory changes at the EPA level are likely to impact waste disposal options for spent media. So, as I stated previously, GAC has a long tenure of application for PFAS treatment. Beyond that, GAC has a long history of application in the water treatment industry to address numerous contaminants of concern, and has, you know, been long utilized to manage other issues outside of PFAS. So as a result, we know a lot about GAC, and we know a lot about how to operate GAC systems. So if necessary, GAC is often selected for rapid deployment in emergency response kind of scenarios. GAC can be derived from a variety of raw materials, often referred to as feedstocks. Three common GAC feedstocks include bituminous coal, sub-bituminous coal, and coconut shell. And to date, GAC derived from bituminous coal feedstocks is often associated with better PFAS removal performance. Some GAC-specific design and operating considerations. The industry is standardized generally around an empty bed contact time of approximately 10 minutes for each GAC vessel. When we talk about performance in general, carboxylates will break through faster than their sulfonate counterparts. And we're also going to see short chain or polyfluorinated PFAS break through relative to the longer chain analogs. Site-specific water quality will dictate pretreatment needs. Elevated concentrations of certain constituents, for example, dissolved iron, manganese, high organic content are common examples of potential foulants that can contribute to scaling or biological growth within the contactors, which would ultimately result in diminished performance. So additionally, if GAC vessels don't include upstream filtration, mechanical filtration, operational backwashes will be required between media chains out media changeouts. As with any adsorbent media, I want to highlight it's important to properly condition the media during commissioning. Product manufacturers will provide guidance on how to properly condition the media during startup. Moving on to anionic ion exchange resins as a field implemented technology. Similar to GAC, ion exchange is a very scalable technology, can be used for very small or very large flows. Ion exchange does require pretreatment and has similar media conditioning requirements during startup and commissioning to GAC. Differences where we deviate from GAC is that ion exchange has a much shorter empty bed contact time relative to GAC. We're talking typically 2 to 4 minutes for ion exchange, which relates to a smaller overall footprint of the treatment system. Additionally, ion exchange is more PFAS selective than GAC, and that means you're going to get more bang for your buck, higher PFAS adsorption capacity on a per mass of adsorbent basis. But that's caveated that ion exchange is typically more expensive compared to GAC on a per mass basis. And the selection for implementation between GAC and ion exchange at a given site is often driven by site-specific factors. And we highly encourage site-specific piloting or bench scale testing to help make that selection. One thing I also want to just make folks aware of is that regarding ion exchange is the emergence of regenerable resins for PFAS treatment. The operating configuration is very similar. We're you know, lead lag and require pre-filtration and pre-treatment. The main difference is that the regenerable resins have the capability through the use of a regenerate solution to restore a bulk of the original adsorbent capacity. But note that this requires separate infrastructure to run this regeneration system, and will also generate a highly concentrated PFAS brine residual that will require off-site disposal. High-pressure membranes. They have a long history of application in the drinking water, wastewater, and water reuse space. High-pressure membranes target the removal of a large swath of organic and inorganic constituents in water, to the extent that some applications of reverse osmosis, or what you might hear commonly referred to as RO, may require remineralization of treated water to, again, put back some of what we took out from a chemistry standpoint. High-pressure membranes serve as a physical barrier to PFAS treatment applications, which provide an additional level of assurance that PFAS spanning a large range of physical and chemical properties are being removed. However, the downside is that the recovery of these systems is often limited by feed water quality and typically results in concentrated reject water residuals that will represent between 10 and 25% of the influent volume. And managing these liquid residuals is, is a major concern and consideration when considering the application of high pressure membrane systems. Quick note, an active area of research right now in the high pressure membrane space surrounds the identification and or development of nanofiltration or NF membranes that are more resistant to fouling at higher recoveries while maintaining a high degree of PFAS selectivity, which would allow us to increase the high pressure membrane system recoveries, be able to get more clean water out, and therefore reduce our overall residual management burden. Moving on to foam fractionation. Foam frac or foam fractionation is an example of a liquids treatment technology that recently graduated from a limited application technology to a field implemented technology. And as discussed in the faint and transport section, many PFAS concentrate at air-water interfaces, and high concentrations have been observed in PFAS foams that form on contaminated water bodies. So foam fractionation leverages and takes advantage of this behavior by introducing bubbles that rise through the water column, collect PFAS, and concentrate in a foam at the top of the reactor. Foam fractionation can be applied with different gases. You can even use ozone, and that you might hear that referred to as ozofractionation, but commonly employed using air. And foam fractionation has been applied at the full scale for PFAS removal at a handful of sites, mostly in overseas, Australia, Tasmania, Europe. However, US applications are coming online. As the foam is generated in the reactor, it is collected at the top and siphoned off and collapsed back into a liquid. The resulting liquid can then be sent to subsequent foam fractionation units, smaller foam fractionator columns that can further concentrate the PFAS. And ultimately, you end up with a final foam concentrate that represents a much smaller volume of material, which would be sent for off-site disposal. And of note, in some cases, on the main line, the treated water may require a polishing step with either ion exchange, granular activated carbon, or RO to get to the treatment objectives, whether they be non-detect or to potentially focus on shorter chain PFAS, which are less susceptible to the foam fractionation process. We've got colloidal activated carbon is another recent addition to the field implemented technologies for liquid treatment and represents the only in situ approach in this category. The core mechanisms underpinning colloidal activated carbon treatment are very similar to the ex situ GAC technology that we already discussed. However, colloidal activated carbon is unique in its delivery and particle size. The colloidal activated carbon is injected into the subsurface to mitigate the vertical and horizontal migration of dissolved phase PFAS impacts. The colloidal activated carbon particle size is typically around 2 microns in diameter, which promotes its distribution within the subsurface, in addition to increasing the adsorption kinetics and enhanced per mass adsorption capacity based on the increased surface area. The longevity of PFAS adsorption in these in situ applications is dependent on many factors and is an active area of research. Existing models suggest that PFAS are demobilized on the order of decades. However, really site-specific testing is warranted to support the development of long-term performance estimates. So it's often necessary to combine treatment technologies into integrated remedial solutions to achieve project objectives. And you might use an integrated approach to address multiple media, whether you're looking at, you know, soil or groundwater or soil and groundwater. This slide focuses on the treatment of water and the water treatment processes. The water matrix can contain, as I've mentioned earlier, you know, numerous potential foulants, TOC, TSS, TDS, which may require pretreatment as they might interfere with the effectiveness of the PFAS-specific technology that you're attempting to employ. So an integrated treatment solution will likely include a combination of treatment mechanisms that may span separation, sorption, and destruction, ultimately. And many factors play into integrated treatment solutions. The overall treatment objectives are key drivers in selecting which treatment technologies you may employ and may necessitate, you know, both a primary, you know, bulk PFAS removal and polishing technologies be employed. And we've talked about, but it's important to note that regardless of whether you're managing PFAS impacted liquids or PFAS impacted solids, that the treatment process is going to generate treatment residuals, and these wastes need to be managed adequately and should be, you know, critically considered in the selection process and in the life cycle cost estimating process. Okay, so we're going to quickly move through. I know we're bumping up on time here. Solids treatment technologies. Let's see. So for solids such as soils, sediments, and sludge, there are a handful of field demonstrated technologies such as excavation and disposal, activated carbon-based soil stabilization, and soil washing. Alternative sorption, stabilization, solidification, and in situ or ex situ thermal treatments are considered developing technologies for soils and are further discussed in the web-based tech reg document if you're looking for additional info on those. Classic dig and haul, a long-standing remedial approach for soil, can be used to manage PFAS impacted soils. One thing of note, you know, when you're looking for a landfill to dispose of these PFAS impacted soils, you're going to want to do your due diligence and make sure that that landfill is willing to and can accept the PFAS impacted waste, because not all landfills are currently accepting PFAS impacted materials. Excavation followed by off-site incineration is also an option. US EPA and DOD, amongst others, are closely investigating the fate and transport of PFAS impacted materials under various incineration conditions. Incineration under the more extreme incineration scenarios, destruction is assumed. However, it has not been very well documented. And as I noted earlier, that the, you know, impending EPA designations under the CERCLA program or RCRA program could in fact affect offsite disposal options. Soil stabilization, specifically with carbon-based soil stabilization amendments, is classified as a field-implemented soil treatment technology. There are additional soil stabilization products, such as engineered clays or cementitious additives, but those are considered limited approaches at this time. And it's, you know, not uncommon for soil stabilization approaches to include a mixture of soil stabilization amendments to meet site-specific remedial drivers or site-specific criteria. Soil stabilization can be performed either in situ or ex situ via specialized mechanical equipment. And the core concept behind soil stabilization is to immobilize the PFAS and prevent it from leaching and impacting other environmental media. A key factor that underpins the success of a soil stabilization approach is getting quality mixing to homogenize the soil stabilization amendments within the soil matrix. And with that in mind, a key consideration regarding soil stabilization is it isn't a destructive approach. It doesn't include a destructive endpoint to the PFAS, meaning that the PFAS remain intact within the soil and may pose a long-term risk. Additionally, implementation of soil stabilization may limit future remedial approaches and should be considered carefully in that context. You know, for example, implementing soil washing, which we will discuss next, may not be feasible following soil stabilization, and you may be limited to off-site disposal, you know, for soils that have undergone a soil stabilization treatment. Soil washing is a field implemented technology that works to separate the fine soil fraction where PFAS is preferentially sorbed from the coarse soil fraction for separate disposal or treatment. In this capacity, soil washing is an ex situ approach and can result in considerable volume reduction of PFAS impacted materials requiring disposal. If the on-site soils are dominated by fine grained materials such as silts or clays, soil washing may not be a viable approach for, you know, reducing the volume of PFAS impacted materials that you have to manage. EPA has a guidance that states soils with less than 25% fines are ideal. Soils with greater than 50% fines may not be viable for this approach. Additionally, during the soil washing process, PFAS phase transfer may occur or be promoted through the addition of solvents or other amendments to the wash water. And this will reduce the solid phase concentrations of PFAS, but will generate a liquid treatment requiring management. And the liquid, you know, side stream may be managed with the different mature liquid stream technologies that we already discussed. Full-scale soil washing plants have been commissioned internationally, Australia and Canada, to name a few. And the U.S. Is undergoing extensive piloting and field demonstration. And the soil washing section 12.3.3 describes ESTCP-funded pilot here in the U.S. that had positive results for soil washing implementation. Finally, incineration is a mature technology that has been used for various solid and liquid wastes, but its impacts on PFAS treatment are less known and really remain an active area of research. Incinerator operation relies on the three Ts: time, turbulence, and temperature. And current research suggests to ensure complete PFAS destruction, incinerators have to operate at the upper end of these criteria and or implement additional stack gas controls, which you may hear referred to as thermal oxidizers or afterburners. Often these operating conditions that we really need to promote complete PFAS destruction are limited to permitted hazardous waste combustor facilities and are not achieved at the standard or under standard operating conditions at municipal waste incinerators. As previously stated, research regarding the fate and transport of PFAS through these incineration processes is an active area of research. One thing we don't want to do is take a concentrated PFAS waste and turn it into a, you know, diffuse environmental contamination issue again. So accurately assessing the level of destruction and potential for emissions of products of incomplete combustion is a primary focus. And so there's approximately two dozen permitted hazardous waste combustors in the U.S. So when you're looking at incineration as a potential destructive endpoint for your PFAS waste, you're going to want to take, you know, overland transportation into account. And that is it for me. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much, Andy. I'm going to just real quick take remote control back. And then we're going to jump right into our last question and answer portion of the training. And then I have a few logistical points for our attendees before we wrap up today. So our first question for our trainers is, let's see here, is using no purge or passive samplers acceptable for PFAS sampling?
Devin, I can take that. So they may be acceptable from a technical perspective, but obviously check with your applicable regulatory agency to determine if passive sampling devices can be used. We do have a subsection on passive samplers in the tech reg 11.1.7.6 for more information.
All right. Thank you, Christy. Next question. Which treatment technologies have been used for drinking water systems?
I will take that one. So pretty much the field implemented adsorbent-based technologies that we discussed, so at the full scale, granular activated carbon, and ion exchange. In addition, our existing RO or high pressure membrane facilities that exist, largely on the coasts, have, do manage PFAS, but they haven't been, they weren't constructed explicitly or implemented explicitly for PFAS removal. PFAS removal is a benefit of having an RO or NF system already in place.
All right, thank you, Andy. Next question. Should composite samples be collected for PFAS analysis, or should grab samples be used? Is it different for water samples versus soil samples?
Well, unfortunately, it does depend on what method you're using and also what media. So, for instance, in US EPA 1633, it strongly discourages the use of composite samples for wastewater due to the surfactant nature of PFAS. However, also under 1633, fish composite samples are acceptable. So, ultimately, it does depend on your project objectives.
All right, thank you, Christy. Next question. Are point of use systems used for private domestic water wells?
Yeah, I would say that point of use or point of entry systems are the most common application for private domestic wells that are impacted by PFAS.
All right, thank you, Andy. Next question. What is recommended frequency for collection of field blanks?
So if we're talking about finished drinking water samples, the frequency recommendation is one field reagent blank for every sample set at each site. And for other media, it really depends on data quality objectives, thinking about equipment blanks versus field blanks for other media, but really it does go back to those that quality assurance project plan and your data quality objectives, and also checking the method.
All right, thank you, Christy. Next question. What options are available to manage used ion exchange media or GAC?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Right now, for GAC specifically, many of the GAC vendors, suppliers will take that material back, the spent GAC, and take it to their pyrolysis units for regeneration. Otherwise, when we're thinking about both GAC or ion exchange, you're looking at landfilling. DoD is recommending hazardous waste landfills or landfills that have controls that are similar to hazardous waste landfills. They may not be permitted as hazardous waste landfills, but landfills with liners and leachate collection systems. And then finally, you've got incineration as a viable DoD recommended disposal alternative.
All right, thank you, Andy. Next question. What is the analysis method for EPA method 533?
So the quantitation scheme, which I think is what this question is getting at, for EPA method 533 as well as 1633 is isotope dilution with extracted internal standard. A difference between 533 and 1633. 1633 looks at primary and conformation ions for each PFAS compound, whereas 533 just looks at the primary ion. But both, all the methods that I spoke in detail about were use liquid chromatography, tandem mass spectrometry. So, hope that answers that question.
Yeah, Christy, keeping in that thread, why is Trisma not used in EPA method 1633?
Ooh, that's a good one. That's because in aqueous matrices in this method, for 1633, they don't typically contain residual chlorine. So 1633, the matrices, the aqueous matrices, groundwater, wastewater, surface water, as contrasted with treated drinking water, which may contain residual chlorine. So that's why Trisma is not used in 1633.
Awesome. Thanks, Christy. All right. One last question here. Are there byproducts produced if PFAS contaminated media are incinerated?
Yeah, so that is really the focus of all these ongoing research efforts and studies, is to determine under what conditions and what incineration control measures with regards to stack gas treatment and such are required to achieve complete PFAS destruction. Because what we do know is that operated under the incorrect or insufficient thermal conditions, that you will generate products of incomplete combustion or other breakdown PFAS breakdown products. So the research is focused around where do we need to get from a time, turbulence, and temperature standpoint to get complete PFAS mineralization.
All right, thank you, Andy. So that does conclude our last question and answer portion of our training today. A few quick logistical things for our attendees. Again, if you're looking for a certificate of completion, they are located on the Clue-In training page that brought you here today. I'll put that link in the chat here in just a moment. If you have any further questions or would like any clarification on any questions asked or responded to today, feel free to get in touch with our trainers directly. Their information is listed on the Clue-In training page. I did just put in the chat. You're also welcome to reach out to ITRC at itrc@itrcweb.org, and we will coordinate a response with our trainers. We would like to hear back from you, even if you don't need a certificate of completion, by way of filling out the feedback form to let us know how the training went today. And again, we do have our next PFAS online webinar, Beyond the Basics, which is open for registration on April 18th. The next PFAS course, which will be April 23rd, that's going to focus on the health effects, has not yet opened for registration, but it will be forthcoming soon. So keep your eyes on the Clue-In training page, and that link will be posted as well as sent out by ITRC's newsletter. I would just like to take a moment to thank our attendees for joining us today, and a big thank you to our panelists and expert trainers for joining us and providing this wonderful presentation. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us. Otherwise, I wish you a wonderful rest of your day. And again, thank you so much for attending.